Well, Douglas supported Lincoln in 1860, but at some arm's length. Mm-hmm. He'd had an up-and-down relationship with the Republican Party since its inception. What Douglas did in the 1850s is he tended to support the Republicans in election years, and then in off-year elections he would support the Radical Abolition Party in upstate New York, which got 40 or 50 votes. Actually, a few more than that. But what Douglas really wanted in 1860 is ultimately what happened, which is astonishing if we think about it. He wanted a breakup of some kind to happen between North and South. He wanted some kind of crisis, some kind of, if possible, even disunion. And he saw in the Republican Party the potential to cause that. I mean, I'm not saying he predicted it and he knew what was coming, but it was that potential, and he uses that very word, the tendencies of the Republican Party to threaten the South, that gave Douglas a sort of party of hope.
But there's also astonishing article in Douglas's Monthly after Lincoln's election in which Douglas says, why on earth the South would contemplate secession when this slave catcher, which he calls Lincoln, the slave catcher, because of his past support for enforcement of fugitive slave laws, why are they contemplating secession with such a man as the president?
Well, for much of the free African-American community, the thought of the South removing itself from the United States, said differently, removing slavery from the protection of the U.S. I mean, think about it. When John Brown invaded Harper's Ferry in 59, he was finally, his raid was finally halted, not by the state militia of Virginia, but by the U.S. military. And what African Americans thought was to take slavery out of the United States was to remove slavery from the protection of the full force of the U.S. military. In fact, I'll quote Charles Lennox Ramon, who said to a group of African Americans in Pennsylvania after hearing that South Carolina was thinking about seceding, he said to South Carolina, "Stand not on ceremony, go at once."
Douglas feared compromise in 1860. He fully expected there would be another compromise of 1850 of some kind, because he didn't know what else to have faith in. In fact, after Lincoln's election, of course, the secession winter of 1860-61 was a terrible time for abolitionists. Douglas, in fact, got himself beaten up in Tremont Temple in Boston. And it was a December or January 60 or 61. So he fully expected somehow there probably would be another compromise of these issues, and he did not yet have full faith of it.
No, but I
well,
mean
there
the
certainly
Crittenden
was. The Crittenden
group
compromise
is
being the most noted. But he didn't know how to put real faith in the Republican Party yet, because it didn't have enough history.
Well, because we want to get to the point where we can invite Charles to come back to the stage, we've got to keep advancing the chronology. So as choppy as it seems, we're going to push ahead past 61 into 62, with Frederick Douglass growing increasingly impatient that Lincoln is not playing the emancipation card to win the war, that ostensibly what Lincoln will only concede to that point is to preserve or to restore the Union. Douglass is writing emphatically in the newspaper, demanding that Lincoln move. How influential is he? Do you think that Lincoln is reading, hearing about this unrest, these demands?
Yeah, you know, Douglas is upset with Lincoln on many fronts. One thing is that, you know, as soon as the war begins, as soon as Lincoln puts out the call for troops, African Americans stand up. They are ready. You know, African Americans have been establishing militia companies in a variety of places, in New York, in Boston, in Cincinnati, and Philadelphia. They have been establishing these military militias, training, drilling, and so on, preparing for what they were absolutely sure would be a war on slavery. They've been doing this since the mid-1850s. So in 61, in the spring of 61, when Lincoln puts out the call for troops, they say, "We are ready." And the federal government turns them down. And Lincoln supports that. And Douglas is very unhappy. So that's one of the things. If, you know, what Douglas says is, why would the president try to fight this war with one hand tied behind his back?
Well, he was more than upset. He was outraged. in the fall of 61 and early 62, the Lincoln administration policy toward fugitive slaves was, of course, to return them to their owners if the owners were loyal to the Union, which eventually became virtually impossible for Union officers to determine. In the fall of 61 and then in the winter of 62, Douglas wrote his most vicious critiques of Lincoln that he ever wrote. He called Lincoln the most dangerous slave hunter in the country. And then he called him an itinerant colonization lecturer. He called him a, quote, genuine representative of Negro hatred. Douglas, at this very moment of the greatest hope in some ways of the possibility of a sanctioned war to destroy slavery, sees now a presidential administration and a military that is organized to return runaway slaves. And it's the most brutal rhetoric, really, that Douglas writes during the war, with the possible exception of his attacks on the Lincoln administration when they tried to make him their colonization czar.
Well, the moment comes, of course, in September. But before we get to it, and I'll confide to the audience that this is something that the three of us want very much to talk about and attack each other on. We've all discussed the imminent attack, or disagreement, shall I say. The extraordinary, disappointing, horrifying meeting that Lincoln has with a deputation, as it's called, of free African Americans from the Washington, D.C. area who come to Lincoln and echo what Douglas has been writing. How long do we have to wait before freedom becomes a part of your program? Jim, maybe you should describe the event, and we'll go from there.
Well, first of all, you got to understand this is an extraordinary event. This is the President of the United States who is inviting black people to come to, not as servants, to come to the White House to have a meeting with him. So, I mean, this is virtually unheard of. There's been one time before Monroe had a black person that he met with for a very short time. But this is really without precedent. And so they come with great expectation. And what Lincoln says to them, among other things, what he says is basically, you guys need to go out and tell your people to support the idea of colonizing yourselves someplace outside of the country. He talks briefly about Africa, but he's open to any possibilities. Some places in Latin America, some places in the West Indies, somewhere. Just someplace outside of America. And one of the things they try to point out to him is, you know, we are Americans. You know, our ancestors fought in the war that made this a nation. Our ancestors...
They don't do it to his face.
No, they aren't allowed to.
They aren't allowed to. They have to go back to... They're really being...
They do in the newspaper, though.
Yes.
They
do and in a letter, right.
Yep.
Well, he started it. He had a newspaper man on the scene for this lecture and shared shared the text of what he'd written in advance.
Douglas was shocked by this and went on the attack. But go ahead. Are you going to...
What I was going to say is that they were, one, disappointed, but they were also just furious that here the President of the United States would... And, you know, you have to consider all this in the light of the history of the time because, in 1857, the Supreme Court of the United States had said in the Dred Scott decision, black people have never been, are not now, and can never be citizens of the United States. And so Lincoln, incidentally, disagreed with that.
But not in that speech.
But not publicly, not in a more public way. But... he seemed to be saying to them, you know, your place is outside of the nation.
Yeah, and you have to understand that in the context of this is the White House itself. These are five handpicked black leaders, so-called, from Washington, D.C., and they are told in explicit terms, our two peoples, quote, must be separated. And then in a lengthy part of that address, Lincoln tells them that they really should think about Central America, where they have good coal mines and good ports. And then he says to them in the end, help me. You should volunteer yourselves. He says, give me 20, 50, even 100, and we can start this process. He asks them to sacrifice themselves for the good of the nation by leaving. It's Lincoln's worst racial moment. Happily, he had a better month coming up.
actually, he also the most before I defend him, which I promised to do, he also told them that they were the cause of all the difficulties.
Right. Your people are the cause of our difficulties.
Right.
The other thing you have to understand is how this idea of colonization had been playing in the free black community. You know, what we have seen in the 1820s and 1830s is that many black institutions are changing their names. They initially had a lot of institutions named with Africa or African in the title. So, for example, the African Baptist Church in Boston, which was started in 1805, one of the earliest black churches. But in the 1830s, it changes its name to the First Independent Church of the Free People of Color. And they explain why, for the very important reason that the name African is ill applied to an organization of American citizens. What they are doing here is they're not so much rejecting Africa as they are rejecting the American Colonization Society. 1816, the American Colonization Society forms, and their whole purpose is to get blacks out of America and to Africa. Now, they're the people that set up Liberia in the early 1820s, and they want to get blacks out of America. So what they are really doing is defending themselves against the program of the American Colonization Society. So to have Lincoln say this is a slap in the face that comes at the end of a long process of trying to remove yourself from the target of the colonization movement.
So are you ready for my defense?
Yes.
Okay. Can't wait.
See it. We're listening.
Lincoln has already written a first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation when he holds this meeting. At William Seward's suggestion and good explanation, we've done so badly in the field that this is going to be seen like the Pope's bull against the comet, so table it, and he does. I view this as part of his disinformation campaign. It was very Nixonian. I'm not saying that's a compliment, but it was very Nixonian. He is telling his white audience, why else have a reporter from the mainstream white press on the scene? He's telling his white audience in the border states, which he is petrified of losing to the Confederacy, and the whole game, as he puts it, rather blithely, but it's a good metaphor, that this war is not to liberate black people and place them among you. I am for deportation. As ugly as it is, a few weeks later, he writes a letter to Horace Greeley, which is all very famous, but is equally disingenuous without being quite as offensive. He says, whatever I do about slavery, I do to save the Union. What I forbear to save the Union. Well, he's now days away from the Emancipation Proclamation.
Public opinion at all times, and he was brilliant at it. But he still has Montgomery Blair, a cabinet member, appealing after both Emancipation Proclamations in 63 to none other than Frederick Douglass to come join the government and run the colonization program. It couldn't have been a more offensive thing to do. Now, it's possible Lincoln didn't even sign off on that. He just gave Montgomery Blair responsibility for running colonization if they could ever pull it off. There could not have been a more offensive act toward black America than that overture to Douglass to run the colonization plan.
Well, that's true, but you know, one thing you also have to understand in terms of assessing Lincoln during this period, don't forget, Lincoln is under tremendous pressure. You know, when Lincoln runs for the Senate in Illinois in 1858, he has these debates with the other Douglas. I'm talking about the Stephen A. Douglas in the senatorial campaign. And Stephen A. Douglas says to the Illinois audience, he says, you know, this guy will not only lead... His policies will not only lead to the end of slavery, but these policies are going to lead to racial equality. And then he really hits them. He promotes interracial marriage, he says. Now, here is Abraham Lincoln running for the Senate in Illinois, 1858, and he's got to defend himself against supporting interracial marriage. You know what Lincoln says? He says, look, you know, Senator Douglas says it's confused. He ought to understand that just because I do not want a Negro woman for a slave does not mean I necessarily want her for a wife. Well, he goes on through this whole litany of trying to defend himself against these charges. And so much of what we're hearing here is what Lincoln has to say in order to remain viable as a political candidate. And as we move to the election of 1860, where he's running for the presidency of the United States, he really has to make himself acceptable to not only the North, but to the border states, because we got a lot of states that are slave-holding states, states like Delaware, for example. State, you know, my home state of New Jersey still has 16 slaves that are freed by the 13th Amendment in 1865. So we have states that are going to remain in the United States that are...
But, Jim, let's ask Harold.
Yeah, what?
Were all those gradual plans of emancipation that he offered to Delaware and Kentucky and so on, were those all nothing but public relations as well? Lincoln preferred gradualism. Instinctively, he preferred gradualism.
But I like what... this is by way of not answering your question. I like what Douglas...
Moderator, I forgot.
I like what Douglas said in September, or I guess in October 62, in response to the preliminary proclamation. He said, Lincoln is guilty of slothful deliberation, but yeah, because of his slowness, he will never be guilty of retraction.
Well, and that turns out to be true.
What was your question again? So, well, in what period are we talking? We should just move ahead so we can get to the watershed year of 63, that the proclamation is issued, a 100-day countdown to its final effect for the final proclamation. And then in December 1862, Lincoln gives his annual message to Congress, which is what today's State of the Union messages are, except the presidents don't go and deliver it them themselves. They send a clerk. They send a written copy. They're read aloud, probably in a desultory manner by a clerk. But people get to read it all across the country. And we remember this ringing peroration. We cannot escape history. We will be remembered in spite of ourselves. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. But we should also acknowledge what preceded that, which is extraordinary for December 1st, 1862.
It's a long appeal for colonization. It's yet in the presidential annual message. That's a gorgeous piece of rhetoric, and it still rings when you hear it. And it is ultimately a kind of explanation of what the war is beginning to do, ex post facto. But it comes after a very formal appeal for colonization as one way of settling this problem.
And compensated emancipation.
Yeah, but one thing we have to understand, though, is that after Abraham Lincoln issues the formal Emancipation Proclamation in 63... A month later, he does not return to the question of colonization. He doesn't build colonization in as a condition for emancipation. He never speaks publicly about colonization again. Now, I argue that what happens is that after the Emancipation Proclamation, and very important, after the role that African Americans play in the war itself, and after he comes to know Frederick Douglass, Lincoln undergoes a marked change, that the man that we see in 64 and 65 is not the man that we have seen in the early 60s or in the 50s.
And
Lincoln's greatest capacity was growth, and this is where it happens.
Capacity for personal growth. Don't let anybody tell you about flip-flopping, because Abraham Lincoln is my A number one American flip-flopper. He flipped and flopped in the right direction. He learned from experience, he learned from history. And it seems to me that's the mark of greatness, a person who shows a capacity for personal growth. So if you want to call that flip-flopping, I wish we had some other people who would flip and flop in that direction.
Well, as we move towards 63 and we examine the question of whether some of that flipping and flopping was influenced directly by Frederick Douglass, let's go to the poetry that paralleled the prose of the Emancipation, because as a document, it is dry and legalistic. We won't go into the cliches about it, but at Gettysburg in November 1863, Lincoln gives some poetic voice to this new vision for America. Charles Turner.
Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, November 19th, 1863. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.